The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Global Reach. This is a show that helps your business realize opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the global marketplace. This week, we tackle a question of biblical proportions. But it's how do we breed principal leaders in a borderless and highly competitive world? Can you be both an ethical leader and an effective one? Are ethical leaders more or less successful? Now, a couple of weeks ago, we had French American Foundation President Charlie Cobb on this show, and we were looking at the arrogance of institutions and the crisis in 21st century leadership, the growing disconnect between institutions and the people they're supposed to serve. From business to government to religion, we're seeing self-serving leaders who have lost their compass in the rough seas of this borderless economy. They brought about the 2008 global financial meltdown. They've brought us pay without performance, collapsing factories in Bangladesh, gridlock and decaying infrastructure in the U.S., and a seemingly insoluble leadership crisis in Egypt. In short, it is a leadership crisis of global proportions. So how do we turn the tide? How do we reach a new era of accountability? Well, our guest today, who's joining us from Zurich, Switzerland, has come up with some unique and effective answers from a very unexpected source, the Ten Commandments. He's Dr. Thomas Dziesweifel, leadership consultant to institutions such as Google, Novartis, Credit Suisse, and the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He's also the co-author of this amazing book, The Rabbi and the CEO, Ten Commandments for 21st Century Leaders. It's a book with innovative answers and powerful tools for effective ethical leadership that he and his co-author, Rabbi Aaron Raskin, drew from a combination of the ancient traditions of Judaism, the Torah, the Talmud, the Kabbalah, and put together with cutting-edge methodology based on 25 years of coaching international leaders. Well, Tom, welcome to Global Reach. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Tay. It's a great pleasure to be with you and all the listeners.
So the Ten Commandments, they're 3,000 years old, 5,000 years old. How are they relevant to today's leadership crisis and the lack of institutional accountability?
Yeah, that's a big question. And, you know, we were surprised ourselves when we started the book. And at first, we wanted to create some kind of a integration of those ancient commandments and 21st century leadership, modern leadership theory and practice. And the more we explored the commandments, the more they became extremely relevant to today. You know, to give you just one example, if you take the commandment number 2, not to have idol worship, there's
yeah.
so much idol worship today that you could say that people are pursuing fame and fortune at the expense of really having an authentic self-expression. And so the question becomes, how could you have a vision that is truly yours, that is not living something else that maybe your parents told you, or your even your rabbi or your priest, or the culture at large, you know, to really live a life that is yours, that is not imposed upon you by anybody else. So that seems to me an extremely relevant and modern question, even though those commandments, as you said, are 3,000 years old.
So how did you come to write this book? How did you pull together a rabbi and a CEO and do a book on the Ten Commandments? It's basically a leadership book and a guide to successful leadership, in fact, global cross-cultural leadership.
Yes. You know, it's a very strange thing. King Solomon said that the light can sometimes come out of the deepest darkness, and the moment of deepest darkness in recent history was 9/11, which I had the misfortune of experiencing firsthand. I was living in New York at the time, and I was sitting at the Brooklyn Promenade about 300 meters from the World Trade Center at 8:46 in the morning when the first plane hit the Twin Towers. And then, you know, at first I thought it was an accident, and then
as we all
when
did.
The second plane came, I saw that it was an attack on everything that we treasure. And in that moment, I will never forget an hour later, when the first tower collapsed, something collapsed in me. It was almost like something died in me, and my knees gave in, and I had to sit down, and I was weeping. And then the next day, when I was sitting again at the promenade and grieving with thousands of other people over the 2,700 dead in that calamity, it was just before the Jewish New Year, and a rabbi came along. And usually I would basically say, buzz off, I'm busy, I'm reading. And on that day, I was so raw and so shaken that I decided to say yes, hi. And he said, are you Jewish? And I said, yes. I was brought up secular in Switzerland, but I am Jewish. My mother is Jewish. And then he said, would you like to tie tefillin, which is the phylacteries that Jews tie around their arm and around their head to symbolize the connection with God? And I said, I've never done this before. My mother was extremely scared of being Jewish, but today seems like
growing
the perfect
up in Europe,
day
to
begin. And so we tied tefillin together, and it was extremely public for me. I had never been open about this. It was like coming out. And then out of that action, we became friends. He is the co-author, Rabbi Aaron Raskin, and we decided to write a book. And then we started to come together, and he shared all the stories from Judaism, and I shared all the leadership theories from 30 years of what is now 30 years of management consulting and teaching leadership at Columbia and at St. Gallen University. And so then became this incredible dynamic of two minds or two worlds that are clashing, and that's really what the book, what makes the book so rich, I think, is this like two ships clashing against each other and seeing what can become out of this. And, I would go with Faraday, who invented electricity, which was basically a mixture between two different fields. Electricity was a result of chemistry and physics, and that became then electricity, which was a completely new field. And that's what we're attempting to do with the book, is to create innovation, which often comes from marrying two disparate domains, if you will.
That's really quite a story. I remember that day well because I was also in New York.
Mm.
And we actually lost three members of our synagogue, and I lost a dear friend from Germany who was, she survived, but was burned over 80% of her body and died about 30 days later. But I also had a very dear friend who came down from the highest floor to escape from one of the towers.
Mm.
And she made it out and walked all the way to Yonkers. But I think to bring out of that tragedy such a remarkable book is quite a story. Before we go on, I want to tell you a little bit more about our guest. He's told you some of his history. But Dr. Thomas Dietzweifel is the partner and managing director of Manasseh Gay, Leaders in Transformation. as a global executive management consultant and leadership professor, Dr. Zweifel has lived on four continents, and he's helped managers in over 100 countries align on strategy and cause breakthrough results. Tom teaches leadership at Columbia, as he mentioned, and also at St. Gallen University. And he's the author of six leadership books, including Communicate or Die, Leadership in 100 Days, as well as the book that we're talking about today. He lives in Zurich with his wife and two daughters. So, Tom, we've talked about how the book came to be. Do you really think that the use of the Ten Commandments or the Ten Commandments interpreted for the 21st century can restore accountability and transparency to our institutions, to government, to business, to education, even to religious institutions? And we've seen some spectacular failures there.
Yeah, that is a very great question. I would say, I would have to, in true Jewish fashion, I would have to start with a joke. maybe you know this, a rabbi asks a couple, are you actually living the Ten Commandments? And then the husband says, quite irritated, of course we live the Ten Commandments. She lives six and I live the other four. but on a more serious note, there is no magic formula, in my view, but I would assert that if people lived the Ten Commandments, all of them, and it's almost impossible, right, to live all of them at all times. We always fall short. But they're such a great guide for living a life that is right. And that is what the word tzaddik means. You know, a tzaddik, which in our culture would be a sage. In the Jewish culture, a tzaddik is simply somebody who lives correct. Now, you might ask, what is correct exactly? Isn't that up to every person? But Judaism has basically set out to create not only 613 commandments, but basically to set out a system for ethical decision-making that if you actually live, if you approximate it or live up to that, then I think you will live a life that is right.
But our ethics,
you know, obviously you would have to say something about what right means in your
culture. Let me go to the core of the matter. Are ethics important to success in business? We have a global business audience here, Transporter. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to have ethics and principles in business? We have so many leaders that don't seem to have them, and they make a lot of money, and they even make their shareholders a lot of money on occasion.
Yes. You know, I think you could make money in the short term by not being a good person or by not living ethically. But I think if you consistently violate principles of integrity, if you always take more than you give, that's what Churchill said, right? You can make a living by what you get, but you can make a life by what you give. You know, if you want to build a life where you give more than you take, that will make you serious money in the longer term. So you might get away with it in the short term, but I actually think, and you know, I don't really have proof for this. I mean, the stories in the book might be evidence, but you could say those are all biased stories and they're one-sided. But I would say, you know, if you take somebody like a Bill Gates or a Steve Jobs or people that have been extremely successful, like Oprah Winfrey or Michael Bloomberg, those are people, I would say, that have always an attitude of what can I provide? You know, what's a vision that would really help a lot of people, that make a difference in the world? And that's what Steve Jobs said to John Sculley, I think, before John Sculley joined Apple. He basically said, you know, do you just want to spend the rest of your life selling sugar water, or do you want to change the world? And that's what Apple has done. It's actually changing the world. Yes, Steve Jobs also became a very, very wealthy man, but he did it by giving, by making a difference. And I would say Bill Gates had a vision of solving all the computer problems of all the people in the world, you know, so...
And
Oprah Winfrey, you know, was always about making a difference.
Tom, we got to go to break now. But when we come back, we're going to pick up on this. We're going to talk about why you see the 2008 global financial meltdown as an ethical crisis and a leadership crisis, not as a financial crisis, what we might do to avoid another one, and tools that our listeners can use for being both principled and very effective and successful. So don't go away.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Global Reach, everyone. I am here with an extraordinary guest, Tom Zweifel, who is a leadership guru. And we're talking about principled ethical leadership and corporate success, and how do you blend the two. Tom, you were saying that the 2008 global meltdown, so many people lost so much money, countries lost wealth. You're still seeing the effects, unemployment in the U.S., austerity in Greece, Portugal is about to change governments. You said that that's really, it wasn't a financial crisis, that really it was leadership failure. What do you mean?
Yeah, if you go to the source of what brought about the crisis, then I think you would have to say that the financial aspect, the economic aspect, and now, for example, the euro crisis that you mentioned, are only symptoms. And so we went back to the source and said, what is really the linchpin that underlies all those issues and all of the ones that you mentioned in the beginning of the program? And we saw that the linchpin issue is a lack of leadership, and that that without this clear definition and without the moral compass that you mentioned also, that too many people are adrift and have lost a kind of a orientation of how should I lead to really prevent crises like these, or even to get out of this crisis.
So what I want to do now is go through the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
We should all know them by heart, but this is a global audience and we're not going to make any assumptions. But also, what does each one mean in terms of the thesis of your book, 21st Century Leadership? Okay, so the first commandment.
Great. So the first commandment, people might remember, is, I am Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And what we made this into is, can you, and I have to just give you the background, Egypt in Hebrew, the word for Egypt is Mitzrayim, and Mitzrayim means literally a place of narrowness or limitations. So the question is, can you take yourself outside of your limitations, outside of the box of thinking that usually comes from the past? And can you do that with other people as well? So basically, take yourself and others beyond the comfort zone of established wisdoms or assumptions and really, you know, go into new territory. That's what the Jews did. They went out of Egypt into the desert for the promised land. So that's the first one.
And what does that mean to a modern leader? And by the way, we're going to go through the 10, then I'm going to ask you very quickly how we could put them together to avoid a global meltdown of 2015. So
yeah,
going out of the narrowness, what does it mean for a modern leader in two sentences?
You know, there are so many assumptions that we go into. We tend to live in a kind of a corporate slavery, if you will, where you go in and you feel like I know how I have to do it in order to comply with the rules, and you know, my boss has set a certain structure that I need to comply with, and to actually not, you know, destroy that, but to question assumptions, to question our own established wisdoms. That seems to me the basis of all leadership. You know, if you want to go to the extreme, somebody like a Hitler or somebody like a Kenneth Lay of Enron just didn't do that. They did not question their own assumptions, and I think it gets you into trouble.
And they didn't question their own greatness.
Exactly.
Commandment 2, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images, so no idols, including, I guess, no American idols.
Exactly. So the quote here is from Rabbi Zusha, who said, I paraphrase, when Zusha dies in the world to come, he shall not be asked, why were you not Moses? He shall be asked, why were you not Zusha? So the idea is to establish a vision for yourself, a legacy for yourself, a life for yourself that is truly yours, that is not an idol worship, you know, whether you're going for whatever those things are that we all go for, you know, whether it's fame or fortune, and to actually see what's the vision that is truly yours, that is authentic.
So don't worship at the feet of money. Don't worship at the feet of, what, a charismatic leader?
Yeah, you know, and by the way, it's not, I don't find it wrong to go for money. There's nothing wrong with you know, wanting to be wealthy. But wanting to be wealthy will not give you wealth. If you want to be wealthy, you would have to do it like Michael Bloomberg, who actually, you know, went for something very, very large, for some kind of a mission that then gives you wealth because it benefits a lot of people.
Okay. Now, you have a very interesting take on the third commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain.
Yeah, you know, again, a very interesting connection. The word for word in Hebrew is davar.
Uh-huh.
Ledaber means I speak, for example. Ledaber is to speak. But the word davar means not only word, it also means thing. So the very word that is word also becomes thing, and that's what actually happened when God created the world. Jews say that he created the world, or she created the world, in 10 sentences. So, and I think in the Christian tradition as well, in the beginning was the word, I think, is one of the very first words in the Bible. And so if God created the world through language, and you and I are created in the image of God, then we have the power to create reality through language. And I think that has gotten lost. You know, I think we are not conscious to the fact how much our words are actually shaping the reality that we meet. So if I say that my life is hard, or I'm stressed out, or I'm starving, then that will become reality.
It's almost like the visualization technique, but in reverse.
Yeah, you should say that, actually. That, you know, language, as Heidegger said it, the philosopher in Germany, language is the house of being. You know, that whatever you create in language, whether you speak it or listen it, you will give rise to reality through that. You know, that creates something. It creates a world.
I know in working with teams and working with other groups, particularly in a cross-cultural way, but even within the culture, you can get in tremendous arguments and then discover if you talk about, well, what do you mean by this word? You realize that the argument actually had no ground. You were using words differently. Okay, the fourth. We've got now 4 minutes to break. I can't believe this segment is going so quickly. What does keeping the Sabbath day have to do, well, except that that's the way we all schedule our work week, what does it have to do with leadership? What do you mean by the power of no when you talk about this?
Yeah, you know, managers today are so inundated with information, and there's so little time, and there's so much to do, and so many emails, and to actually, whether it's once a week or once a day or once a month, I frankly don't care. I mean, for the Jews, it would be Shabbat, which is once a week. You actually turn off all that stuff. You don't travel. You don't work. You don't talk about money. You don't do financial transactions. And you actually step back and look at the larger picture and look at what is my life, you know, and you get to have a lot of food and to drink vodka and to, you know, even have sex with your spouse and to dance and sing, but not to turn on the computer, not to do phone calls, not to travel. And I find that an extraordinarily beautiful institution. And mind you, it's 3,000 years old. You know, that would have the wisdom of stepping back to see what is my moral compass. Where am I actually going? What do I really want? What's important to me? And, you know, already in the Bible, the great sins of humanity were basically in the name of impatience. You know, whether it was Adam and Eve eating from the tree in the Garden of Eden, or whether it was David and Sheva and trying to seduce her, or the golden calf, it was all about impatience. And so Sabbath is basically about patience.
To learn patience and become a better leader. You talk about honor thy father and mother, and I thought this was interesting. Appreciation is a way to create power.
Yeah, you know, if you deconstruct the word appreciation, it actually means to gain in value, right? Pretium in Latin means value or price, and appreciation means adding price or adding value. So basically, whatever you can appreciate, especially the people that might be tough to appreciate, you know, if you have a boss or a direct report or some kind of a colleague who's really getting on your nerves, you know, what could you appreciate in them? And I think by appreciating that, and it's not about being nice, it's about really finding, why is this person in my life? Why are they there? What is their value? Then that will give you power. It will give you power to deal with them, and it will give you a certain power of being above the conflict with them.
Interesting. Commandment 5.
And mind you, I'm not very good at this sometimes. So just simply because I wrote a book about it doesn't mean I can do it.
Yeah, I think that would take a lot of practice. I think I'm of the, I've got a little list persuasion myself. Okay, next one, and this is honor thy father and mother. Sorry, commandment 6, thou shalt not kill. You're like that to anger management, but there are bosses who've been tremendously effective. Jack Welch, Neutron Jack, I mean, who mm-hmm. really wither people with their anger. So why is manager, did he use it? How do you figure this one is a 21st century principled leader?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in the short term, I think it's, again, a short versus long-term idea. In the short term, you can produce tremendous results by using your anger. For example, the CEO of Rubbermaid, you know, the orange juice company, he basically used to get livid. And under his leadership, the company actually gained in value 3.9 to 1. But after he left, the company immediately lost 59% relative to the market. So my idea is, or our idea, that you can produce short-term results, you can get people to comply with you if you throw a tantrum, but in the longer term, it's not going to be sustainable because you're going to breed people who are afraid of you rather than leaders around you who will do it because they believe in a vision and believe in something bigger than themselves. And I think, I mean, just judging from my own life, that's what gives me productivity is if I am fulfilled by what I do, I believe in what I do, I have a vision, I have autonomy, and not because I'm afraid of somebody.
And I suppose if you literally or figuratively kill off the leaders and innovative thinkers around you, it's an après moi le déluge. You
exactly.
Don't leave much when it comes to succession.
That's exactly right. And you know, that's why in the 12th century, Maimonides, who was a Jewish sage, basically said that if you get angry and embarrass somebody, it is as if you killed the person. So anger actually does kill, and that's why we put it together with you shall not kill as a commandment.
It is withering. It certainly can kill off creativeness and spontaneous application. Seven, thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, you've turned this into walk the talk, which I find a fascinating bridge, and I'm not sure how you got there.
We got there through, again, a word, melech, which means king in Hebrew. And the word melech actually is constructed out of two syllables. Mel means to speak, and lech means to walk. So walk the talk is literally in that word of king or leader. So a leader in Hebrew is somebody who needs to walk the talk, and otherwise you're not allowed to use that term leader.
You know, I've seen so many corporate missions, and they have lofty goals. And they really don't, the companies really don't carry them out. We're doing something recently with the, actually it's not that recent, it's a couple of years ago, with the Communication Workers of America, and Motorola had a subsidiary with people who are doing call answering. Mm-hmm. And they had actually cut the ability, they cut the time that their representatives could deal with customers, especially those who are dealing with customers, Hispanic, Spanish-speaking customers. And you looked at the Motorola credo, which said we, you know, our employees are, and I'm paraphrasing now because it's been about 2 years, but essentially our employees are tremendously important to us, and yet here were employees who are trying to, you know, keep customers and make them happy and solve problems, basically being docked and fined and in some cases fired for spending too much time with customers doing problem solving. And I thought it was tremendous. You see that so often, the difference between the mission statement or the lofty ideals that a corporate leader expresses and what they really do in terms of their, that's part of what our show about the disconnect between the stakeholders and the corporate leadership was, where the communities they're in, the workforce, even the stakeholders get the short end of the stick.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I would say in order to really create integrity on a system-wide level, you would have to, you would have to be a leader who lives by example. I think that goes without, that's the sine qua non condition. As my friend Nick Wolfson says, the fish stinks from the head. So if the fish stinks, it's probably the head that stinks first. Then you would have to sanction non-integrity. So in other words, whoever breaks the values of the company, there would have to be visible consequences of breaking the values. And I think all too many times companies have these values. And by the way, I could show you the values of a company that was lauded by the New York Times and by Fortune magazine in the 90s as the exemplary company. And, you know, I can show you the values of that company, and it's a beautiful value system, except once you hear the name of the company, it's called Enron. You know, that company had beautiful values, but it absolutely did not live by them. And, you know, they came to a fall.
So how do you tell what a company does from what it says? How do you dive in and really find out whether the company and whether the leadership is actually walking their talk?
You know, it's actually very, very simple. I mean, if I walk into a company, I literally talk to the receptionist or I will talk to the frontline people and see how they are behaving. And at any level of management, I will see what the true culture is, right? So there's a declarative policy or declarative culture, which is the one that is in the books. And then you have the real culture, which is what nobody talks about. What are the behaviors? What are the silent rules that are not in the books, but they're apparent, right? If I'm in a meeting and nobody gets to question a boss, then I know that he or she has surrounded themselves with yes men who will not question the assumptions or question the culture, and so I will be pretty sure that that there will be some discrepancy in the value application.
That's interesting. I'll give you another example of a company that did not walk its talk, and that was BP, British Petroleum. I remember seeing a whole bunch of ads talking about how environmentally responsible they were. At the same time, they were having pipeline leaks in Alaska, plant explosions, and I think it was Texas. And then, of course, we had the oil spill, the blowout in the Gulf, all through leadership that didn't insist on quality, that wanted shortcuts.
Yeah,
and it cost
I guess
them billions.
It, you know, it becomes a question of how do you prioritize your values? And all too many times we have an ethical dilemma nowadays, which is between short-term and long-term, or between individual gain and collective gain. And, you know, the shareholders of the company actually contribute to the pressure on the management. You know, so anybody who owns shares in BP also had an interest in short-term gains. So, you know, I don't want to make it too easy and just blame top management and blame the supervisory board, because they all are accountable to the shareholders as well. And if the market is clamoring for short-term performance, then it becomes extraordinarily difficult to withstand that pressure. And one of the very few people that I know did that was the head of Porsche, for example, who literally refused to go along with the short-term stock expectations of the German stock exchange and actually said, I'm not going to do this, because we have a long-term strategy, and I'm not willing to forsake the strategy and the quality for short-term gain. And he just refused to do it. But that takes a tremendous amount of courage. So I just want to say, you know, my heart goes out to top managers who are standing in that tension. Let's face it, they're also people, you know, and they are dealing with multiple stakeholder pressures, and it's a tough challenge.
So how do you institutionalize integrity, and how do you get people to ride with you for the long term? And I know in these days of program trading, that's hard, but...
Yeah, I would surround myself with people who question me. And, you know, as a partner at Manres and as a former CEO of another company, I remember how easy it is to be surrounded by people that adore you and admire you and say, you're so great, and don't question you. But I always said to my people, you have to question me, you have to challenge me, because I'm blind, right? There's no one person who can know everything. And so that's the first step. You have to have the guts to surround yourself with people who disagree with you. You have to encourage dissent or even discord, as long as it's within alignment on the strategy, right?
How do you keep people from shooting the messenger? And we've got to go to break now. So
yep.
We are going to go to break. When we come back, I want to go back to this because I think this is so central. Mm. How do you institutionalize integrity, and how do you do this when it does clash with the bottom line, not just your stock price, but with your profitability and with your performance? Don't go away. We'll be back in a minute.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone, to Global Reach. We are talking about the Ten Commandments and 21st Century Leadership and how to solve the global leadership crisis. We've been talking about integrity and this real tension between institutionalizing integrity and the bottom line, institutionalizing integrity and the short-term view of the stock market, and how does a leader balance the two, and really how does that work into the long-term health of their company? So, again, bottom line and performance. What do I do if I want to be a principled leader and a leader with great ethics and integrity, and I still want to keep my bottom line going? What about, you have in your example the book of the example of Ford, mm-hmm. where the scion of the family came in as leader, very environmentally conscious, and they produced gas-guzzling SUVs.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example, and I think it goes to show that there are those ethical, what I call ethical dilemmas, right? It's one thing to choose between good and bad. It's another thing to choose between one good thing and another good thing, and that's the definition of an ethical dilemma. And so what I would recommend people do is that they put that dilemma on the table. And in the book, we actually show four different dilemmas, you know, short-term, long-term. I'm not going to go through all of them, but justice versus mercy is one of them, individual versus group. And actually put them on the table and say, we got these shareholders, and then we got these other interest groups, and we got the people, and we got the customer, and we got profitability, and we want to save the environment. And then to actually say, what are our priorities? You know, how do we live our priorities? And the way, for example, Johnson & Johnson did this is that they put the patients first. And they said, you know, if it came to pass that we have a dilemma between our profitability and the patient will come first. And then second will come the doctors and nurses. And only last will come the shareholders. And that was a very clear decision in their credo, which is still taught in business schools around the world.
And they used it in the handling of the Tylenol poisoning incident, mm-hmm. which is a classic textbook. As I remember, I covered this when I was the editor of Business International. And it was really the checklist that you set up as the classic checklist for handling a crisis.
and keeping your company's reputation. And I think there's something very interesting that you brought up in the book, you and the rabbi, about reputation long term. Where you can lose your reputation or you can make some money, but you had some very classic things to say about that.
Yeah, I believe that it was that you get from integrity what you cannot get from any other resource, which is a sort of power that is truly yours. You know, I'm thinking of the tobacco executive Jeffrey Wiegand, who basically lost almost everything, but he said, I can look in the mirror every day. You know, when I look in the mirror, I can see myself. And that kind of power you don't get from a job title, you don't get from a lot of money, you don't get from the corner office. It's a sense of I am being me, you know, and I think that's the most powerful thing. Then there are some additional things that you have to do if you want to institutionalize integrity, which is, number one, as I said earlier, you have to sanction non-performance. So if people are not living the values of the company, you would have to really pay them some consequences or rig the incentives in a way that they're tied up with the values, living the values. Number two, you would have to, demonstrate integrity in your own life. And number three, to look at all the new hires in a way that you would have the best people in your company, the ones who live the values the most, actually interview those people. So don't just have interviewing new people be done by the HR department, unless they're an example of the company values, but choose the role models in the company to interview new people. And I think that would, or onboard new people, and that would probably breed a new culture throughout the company.
So as opposed to incentivizing just pure bottom line performance, which sometimes can be fictionalized, as some of the banks we've seen, where their traders fictionalize their results and have put a couple of banks out of business, really incentivize the integrity as part of the contribution to the long-term bottom line. Is that, am I summarizing you correctly?
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better. And you are definitely more bottom line than me, so I like it the way you say it.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of a brand. If I have seen a brand that's got, you know, a 100-year or even a 10-year reputation for integrity, I'm more likely to forgive them a mistake. First of all, I'm more likely to be a customer if I can really believe in the integrity of a product and a company. And I'm more likely to be forgiving if they run into a problem. You know, I'll believe Johnson & Johnson, more likely to, because of Tylenol. Frankly, because Starbucks pays for health care for its workers, I tend to, you know, I'll shop there even though they're on every corner, and I sort of like individual stores. It's an interesting clash for the customer.
Yes. And, you know, if you think of what builds trust, you know, because I think what you're talking about is really a breakdown of trust, you know, that the public has lost the trust of certain institutions.
Which is what the last show was about.
Exactly, which was the show with Charlie Cole, was exactly about this. And my answer would be, and this is, very easily said and not easily done, but building trust comes down to two things. Number one, make commitments, and number two, keep commitments. If you do those two things, you know, there will be trust by your people, by the shareholders, by the public. That's what it comes down to.
And I'll go back, we're talking about institutionalizing, and it reminded me of a project that I did, something that used to be called Transborder Data Flow, which was the precursor of the Internet. And trust today, because you are so exposed on the Internet and on Facebook, is very important. But this was a precursor. It was a time when all of the European countries were enacting privacy legislation, and they didn't want to let what they call name-linked data, personal data, out of their countries where it was protected, going to the United States, which had something like 25 pages of different laws which you couldn't follow, couldn't understand, and contradicted each other. So companies in the U.S. devised a system where they would sign a pledge that they would treat European data in the way that their laws protected it in Europe. Problem was, all the leader, you know, we all these CEOs signed the pledge, and I went around to, I interviewed about 100 companies, and almost no one below the sea level knew about that pledge. All the people who were treating the data had no idea about what they were supposed to be doing. So you really have to, it's a lot of inside and inner corporate learning. You really have to take whatever you're setting up as your goals, you've got to put it through the ranks. Make sure
Absolutely.
You can actually walk that talk.
Exactly. And, you know, that also brings us back to the third commandment, which is that you have to communicate in a way that really goes all the way to the front lines, right? And communication is not only talking to them. I'm reminded of a CEO who I told years ago about the importance of two-way communication. And he said, of course I do two-way communication. He was kind of irritated. Of course I do two-way communication. I write to my people and I talk to my people.
Right.
And he completely forgot about the listening part, right? So if the bosses in your example had actually listened through the ranks, they would have found out that people are actually not even knowing about this, let alone doing it.
This leads us to another one, and unfortunately, we are almost out of time. We've got about 4 minutes left for the entire show. But bearing false witness, we have had an awful lot of leaders who have lied to the public and lied to their people. How do you, you know, particularly when their companies are doing badly, when things are breaking down, what do you do with that?
Yeah, so we had a very particular interpretation of you shall not bear false witness, and this took us a while. But we basically said the mark of a great leader is to look reality straight in the eye, to face reality. Because if you look at the CEOs that failed, and there was actually a study in Fortune magazine of all the CEOs that failed a few years ago, and the one thing that was common to all of them is that they did not get the warning signs, right? They were so a legend in their own mind that they never faced the facts, as Jack Welch would call it. And so the first step you have to do is you actually have to, what we call, declare a breakdown. And by declaring the breakdown and making it public and saying, you know, this is not acceptable, whatever the breakdown is, then you can go to the second step and say, why is this a breakdown? What is our vision that is being interrupted? What do we ultimately want that makes this into a breakdown? Because a breakdown only exists in relation to a commitment. And then the third step is to look for options for the breakthrough. So that's the three-step process. And the key is and that's the first step, is to look reality in the eye and say, if we keep going this way, it's not going to work out. And that's what a lot of people don't do, right? They're kind of resting on their laurels or being complacent, and then things go over budget or they break down in some way, and then you really get a crisis.
So that's the way you make lemonade out of lemons. We are almost at the close of this show. I just want to go very, very briefly into, you turned Thou Shalt Not Steal into giving back, and in other words, contributions to the public good, and it's something we saw in an earlier show where one of my guests was doing corporate communications for FedEx in China, and they found that if they encouraged their employees to give back, they attracted the highest caliber recent graduates out of university. And the last one I thought, which was really interesting, which I think we're going to have to do in a different show, is this question about 10, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. And for that, you talk about a really critical skill in terms of empathy and the ability to decode another culture. If you can give me, because we literally have 2 minutes and we need to do some things for closing out, what is the key there, and what are we going to talk about in a follow-up show about this?
Very good. So you briefly talked about Commandment 8, right? Don't steal, and it's really about giving
right.
back. And since we talked about this earlier on the show, I think I'm going to go straight to Commandment 10, which is, as you said, don't covet. And the key there is, rather than comparing yourself to somebody else and separating yourself from them, you could actually stand in the shoes of them, whether they're your friend or your customer or your competitor or your enemy, doesn't really matter. If you stand in their shoes and look at the world from their point of view, which is, as we all know, quite a difficult challenge, then you will see how they tick, and you will see their value system and their mindset, and their, you can foresee their strategic moves. And I would assert that's what the U.S. military had to do with Al-Qaeda. That's what Google had to do with Microsoft. It doesn't matter, you know, who the adversary is or who the partner is. You have to stand in their shoes and see the world from their point of view rather than from the selfish viewpoint of only yourself.
And I would
and this
think
is probably
that
one of the most difficult things in the world.
I would think, Thomas, that that's also at the core of managing a cross-border business, dealing with cross-border customers, cross-border suppliers, and your own cross-border labor force. And I want to do a whole show on that and tie it in with your new book that's coming out on Culture Clash 2, which is a lot about cross-cultural communication, which, as you know, is one of my favorite topics. Tom, very quickly, how can they find you? What's your website?
First, my company's website is manres.com. M-A-N-R-E-S, as in sugar, .com. And my personal website is thomaszweifel.com.
Well, this has been a terrific show. Next week, Rita Gunther McGrath, who's also out of Colombia, is going to talk about the end of competitive advantage and transient advantage. The following week, we've got another guest from Switzerland, Ralf Schoenenbach, who I know from Goucher College, where he's on our board of directors, but he's in a very interesting project. He was on our first month of the show on women entrepreneurs, and now he's going to come back to talk about a unique program that his Trestel Group and UBS and other Swiss banks have put together on creating a pipeline of women entrepreneurs in Tanzania. In August, we've got Dr. Paul London on the competition solution, and Maria Inahosa is going to join us with other guests on business economies and immigration. So I want to thank everyone for tuning in. We'll see you next week at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 8 p.m. Central European Time. Meanwhile, Tom, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Tay, and I hope that people will join us on this lifelong journey of discovery, how to live in the 21st century.
And we wish you a week with great success in extending your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.